Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is a special report from ABC News, Race for the White House. I'm Chuck Sievertson. Breaking news, Vice President Kamala Harris has secured commitments from enough delegates to become the presumptive Democratic presidential nominee, according to ABC News reporting. Harris today speaking to staffers at their campaign headquarters in Wilmington, Delaware.
Over the next 106 days, we are going to take our case to the American people, and we are going to win.
Many now wondering who might be tapped to be Harris's running mate. Names being mentioned include North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper, Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro, Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear, and former astronaut and Arizona Senator Mark Kelly. Donald Trump running mate J.D. Vance at a rally in Radford, Virginia, said they'll fight to bring down the cost of groceries and housing if elected. He didn't as yet mention how the government could do that. This is ABC News.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
Civic Media News, I'm Ella Sapp. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. The Democratic Party of Wisconsin enthusiastically endorsed Kamala Harris on Monday, now that she's the frontrunner for the Democratic ticket. Ben Wickler, chair of the Wisconsin Democratic Party, said Harris is the candidate best positioned to defeat Donald Trump.
Vice President Harris is a powerhouse debater and communicator, and we've seen that all the way through her political career. She's able to bring a spotlight to the essential issues and draw the essential contrast that will ensure that we can win this election.
Wickler described Biden's resignation as a reset that gives Democrats the upper hand in the upcoming election. Wisconsin was ranked first in the nation for hourly earnings growth in February, March, and May, and second in the nation in April. Just last month, Wisconsin reached record high employment numbers. Governor Tony Evers said Monday that Wisconsinites are clearly working hard as the economy continues to show positive growth. And that's what you need to know. I'm Ella Saff, and this is Civic Media News.
When I smoke weed, I get lost in the music. I like to isolate each instrument, the rhythmic bass, the harmonies on the piano, sticky melody.
Hey, careful, babe. There's someone crossing the street.
Sorry, I didn't see him there.
If you feel different, you drive different. Don't drive high. It's dangerous and illegal everywhere. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Eagle 1490 AM.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about on Sunday. President Joe Biden announced that he was stepping aside, passing the torch to Vice President Kamala Harris for this campaign, going to finish out his term, focus on getting done the things that he wanted to do in the first term, but handing over the torch. Interesting, watching the freakout. I personally remember Nikki Haley during the Republican primary saying, the first party to retire its 80-year-old candidate will win this election. And I think she's right. I think Joe knew, as I said from the beginning, was going to do what was in the best interest of the country. He saw what was coming after that debate and said, look, it's time to pass the torch. And in the good and the best of the country did that. But there's the Nikki Haley supporter pack, the voter pack, who now has come out and endorsed Kamala Harris. Interesting. And you got to wonder how many Republicans now are going to go, well, we've been hating Joe Biden for so long. We've been trained to hate Joe. All of our Let's Go Brandon material is now worthless. Now what are we going to do? Could be following the lead of the Nikki Haley pack there, of the voter pack, and going towards Kamala. Now, going to be interesting because, understand, as Biden left, money started flowing in. In fact, Sunday it's been reported more than $30 million into the coffers Every state Democratic Party chair by Sunday night had thrown their support to Kamala Harris. It's interesting watching now the party find some unity. Now, President Obama says that he would like an open process to choose the nominee. I don't think that's going to happen. I think the open process is everyone. I think everyone will get behind Kamala Harris, and I think it may happen this week. Joe Manchin, evidently, there's someone saying that he's considering to become a Democrat again, and he's considering to maybe run for president. And the only person who wants Joe Manchin to run for president clearly is Joe Manchin. There will be no support for him. Now, again, I think we will see by the end of this week if anyone steps forward. It's a big undertaking to fire up a presidential campaign, to get the staff, to get the field operation, to do all that. I think what's going to happen, I think everyone will come together around Joe Biden's wishes of Kamala being the nominee, and we'll get behind her in a big way. Because ultimately, look, Democrats are not about they're not about one person. This has never been about Joe Biden. And I've said this before. I voted for a set of ideals. I voted for a direction, a vision. Biden, in my view, was supposed to be a one-term president anyway. He was supposed to be the guy who calms everything down, which he's done amazingly. He's supposed to be the guy who changes our direction, sets us on the right path, gives us the tools, and says, go. I think he's done that pretty well. And he's now chosen Kamala Harris to be his successor. He's passed the torch. It's time to get in line. Time to move the agenda forward. Understand, for me, it's about winning. Now, the other side, everyone knows the Republican Party right now is the party of Trump. There's no question about that. There's no one in that party with the kind of juice that he's got. No one. No one can challenge his power. We even saw Nikki Haley, who I got to tell you, a little surprised seeing Nikki Haley bowing at the RNC, endorsing him. Look, Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz, the rest of them. Yeah, I get it. But Nikki Haley? Especially after the claim that, whoever retires their 80-year-old candidate first will win. So I guess she's predicting a Biden win. Now, look, I go back to what I said. I think Joe sat long and hard, looked at the polling like everyone else did, looked at their internals, and said, look, maybe I just don't have what I had. Because understand, in September, if he would have gone through another debate, it wouldn't matter how well he did. The bar would have been so high that no one would have reached it. Trump would have just had to show up. Even if he drooled all over him, it wouldn't have mattered. Now, what'll be interesting is watching Democrats pivot on the age issue and go after Trump. And the question that I have, will our mainstream media now start paying attention to all of the gaffes and the misstatements and the forgetfulness and the calling of the wrong names and all of the dementia type stuff that they called out for Biden? Will they now turn to Trump and do the same thing? Will we now see that machine that some of my Democratic friends think pushed Biden out, will you see that machine now turn to Trump? I don't think so, because understand the moneyed interests, they want Trump. That simple. Now, will there be a fight over Biden's choice? I don't think so. At this moment, I'm betting that everyone, like all the state party chairs and the moneyed interest, I'm betting everyone goes, look, we've got to take on Trump. We've got to beat this horrible Project 2025. We've got to beat this machine. We've got to make sure that our candidates are funded, are sourced, and are ready to go, and that we're all on the same page. And I'm betting that's where we're going to be. I'm betting the convention is going to be a coronation, not a messy, open, ugly convention. And look, that could be good too. Who knows? But I'm guessing, and that's, we'll know more as the week goes on, but I'm guessing it's going to be a unity thing. I'm guessing it's going to be a solidarity thing, and all about just how bad Donald Trump was for working people, how chaotic his administration was, how chaotic things were even before the pandemic. Now, know, if there is an open convention, who will it be? Evidently, someone threw Joe Manchin's name out. And who could that be? I'm guessing Joe Manchin. I'm guessing the only person in the Democratic Party who wants Joe Manchin to mess things up is Joe Manchin. So maybe he'll seek some attention. I don't know. But we'll see. Finally, the thought, who's going to be the VP? I mean, that's the big prize, isn't it? Who will she choose to be her running mate? There have been a lot of names out there. Gretchen Whitmer's name has been thrown out as an all-female ticket. I have some female friends who are like, yes, that's what we want. You know, I've heard a bunch of names. Mark Kelly, the senator from Arizona. I personally like Sherrod Brown. In a tough race in Ohio, that would be conceding that seat to a Republican. But I got to tell you, I think the right person, I'm going to go with Pete Buttigieg again. I think he's somebody who will stand up to J.D. Vance and have a great story to tell to match Vance's story. And in a debate, hands down, I'm putting my money on Pete Buttigieg. That simple for me. So this race just got really exciting. The energy is going to be, you know, Trump loves to talk about energy. This just energized this campaign. And the question is, can Trump keep up with the energy? And how much crazier is he going to get? And how much of the quiet stuff is he going to say out loud, especially on the race issue? Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I got an email from a listener last week that caught my attention. You remember we talked about Teamsters President Sean O'Brien appearing at the RNC convention, effusive with praise at the beginning. And then look, two-thirds of that speech is it's stuff I say every day and been saying every day for the last 20 years on this program. But, you know, it's that third that I got a problem with. But the email says, look, I like your show. I've been a viewer for a long time. I'm here to express my unwavering support for Teamsters President Sean O'Brien and his willingness to stand up for the rights of workers. I am too. Love the fact that he does that. Just not there. He said, while I understand and respect your statement on the matter, he is the president and in charge. He should be given your support. We'll see. But then does this weird kind of flip. Says, I support the role of that unions play in protecting workers' rights. In the private sector, I must express my disdain for government unions that represent coddled teachers and lazy career bureaucrats. They do not need unions, according to this person. They are servants of the people, he says, and should be accountable to the people. We both know it's impossible to fire a bad teacher or government employee. But I did. And then another weird flip. I found your segment on the high cost of rent. Infuriating. Glad Biden is doing something. So a couple things there. But the one I want to get to is this assault on government workers, especially unionized government workers. And here to share some thoughts on this certain email, I've asked my good friend Phil Glover to come talk with us. Phil's the AFGE District 3 National Vice President. Phil, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks, Rick. Appreciate having me back.
So, look, you're somebody who represents these, how did it go again? Lazy career government bureaucrats.
That's us.
Yeah. Who are you?
Well, that was interesting when I read that. I wonder if this individual understands what the federal workforce does, and especially the unionized federal workforce. You know, we have the Veterans Affairs nurses and doctors. They're unionized people. They're out there helping veterans. We have all the people that work at VA hospitals, including the groundskeepers and the folks that keep the rooms clean for those veterans and all of that, physical therapy, all the things that are done for veterans. We represent those folks. And then we have the Federal Bureau of Prisons, which keeps criminals locked up across. And in Pennsylvania, that's 9 federal prisons and thousands of employees that keep, you know, your community safe every day. And, you know, they're unionized. You've got the Border Patrol, who are, you know, everybody's favorite on the conservative side of the aisle. And, you know, those are unionized workers in AFG. And, you know, I could go on. Department of Defense workers, they the workers out of Toby Hinn Army Depot, for instance, they actually deploy with the military to keep their equipment operating properly when they're in the field. So you have civilian workers out there along with the military. And those are unionized federal workers. And, you know, we have a meat inspectors. Let's talk about your meat and food safety. Those are federalized union workers that work in those meat plants and make sure that your food's safe. And I could go on and
sure.
on.
I mean, you could go into EPA inspector, OSHA inspector.
Sure.
You go down the line of all of the things that our government does, all of those jobs from, you know, sanitation workers to, you know, yeah. to people who keep the parks and, you know, our, you know, police and teachers. And going after teachers is, again, another one of those things where it's an easy target. Government's always been an easy target to attack. And interestingly enough, and this is where the reason I brought you on to talk about this email in particular is, you know, there is a support right now for unions, and the right has done a masterful job in trying to divide workers' ability to join unions by classifying them private and public. We're okay with those private sector unions. They're okay because they're weak right now and have to go through a whole bunch of hoops to join a union. But it's the public sector where there's actually some decent density. And it's a little more easy to join and to do things. It seems interesting that this came up now, given the fact that we just had the political theater there with the RNC.
Yeah, and I think, you know, what I don't understand about someone who supports unions, support all unions. All workers should be able to join a union, no matter if you're public sector, private sector. It shouldn't matter. We all need protection from bad management. We need protection from bad decisions or even inadvertent decisions, let's say on pay or on your benefits. Let's say your retirement gets screwed up. The union goes in there and helps fix those things. That's what we're for. And so, you know, we're supposed to advocate for our workers in no matter which sector you're in. And I have been in the private sector as a union member. I was in the Steelworkers Union years ago when I was a kid. I was in UFCW for a little while, and I support all unions. And I think that's what we should get back to is supporting all unions and not letting anybody carve us up.
Yeah, no,
that's a huge problem.
Every worker should have at least the security of knowing that they can't be fired for any or no reason. But they hit on this point that, you know, we both know it's impossible to fire a bad teacher or government employee. I know that's nonsense. I think you know that's nonsense. But explain, you know, where this mentality comes from, because I hear it a lot. I hear it from a lot of people in a lot of different, even some union members say, well, you know, it's too hard to fire somebody. Any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, look, we have people fired daily in the federal workforce. I mean, this isn't, you know, there are people that get fired. People, especially bad people who do the bad, you know, bad things. If we have a worker at a VA who abuses a veteran, we want that process to work, but it's a process. The one thing that we stand for is that our contracts, the way our contracts work and the way the policies work, need to be held to account. So if a manager wants to fire an employee, they have to document. There has to be a real investigation. It can't just be, hey, Phil Glover's a pain in my butt, and tomorrow I'm going to put him on the street. That's not how it works in the federal government, because we have policies that state they have to lay out, what did you do? They have to give you a chance to respond. They also have to have an investigation and present those facts to the third part, to a third party, which is an arbitrator or somebody else. That's just fairness.
And no, so it's due process. Phil, it's basic due process. It's a basic American value. We don't just pick people off the street and throw them in jail. They get a chance to defend themselves. They get a chance to confront their accuser. Why should it be any different in the workplace?
It absolutely shouldn't. And that's the problem with this mentality of these at-will workers. They want everybody to be at-will. This, you know, segues into a few things here. But they want to make everybody an at-will worker, where you walk in tomorrow and I don't like your look. I'm going to send you home. You're fired. Yeah. That is just should be unacceptable in the United States of America.
Or the other side of this, Phil, and this is where the segue is. Or they fire you because I don't like your politics. They come in and, you know, there's been talk of if Trump wins in November, that in January they're going to enact something called Schedule F, and I'll give you a minute to explain what that is. And they're going to fire all the federal workforce and replace them with good loyalists, basically making patronage great again under this Project 2025. Is this what you're talking about?
Absolutely. This goes back to prior to Truman, essentially, his era, where as a new administration comes in, we get rid of a whole bunch of civil servants and we bring in a whole bunch that like me and what I like to do. Schedule F would essentially set up a plan to ensure that about 50,000 federal workers would become at-will workers. And they would be able to get rid of all 50,000 and bring in 50,000 new feds that are loyal to the Republican Party. Or
eventually the Democratic Party.
It could be, depending on who's taking over. This could backfire on some people that think that's a good idea. But right now, the federal civil service are hired through merit hiring practices. It's standardized. You have to have qualifications. You go through interviews, and you get to work in the federal government, and you have a pretty stable career. They want to be able to come in. Right now, there's only 4,000 presidential appointees on the political side, people that run agencies like the secretaries and their underlings, their deputy secretaries. Those are all political appointees. And as they go out the door, as a new administration comes in, the new president has a right to pick about 4,000 of them. That's enough to drive your agenda if you do it right. Problem is, the last administration, they didn't hire all 4,000. They barely put, I think, 2,000 people in place, thinking that they would disrupt government to the point that it wouldn't function.
It's those people that those 50,000 they want to go after now who actually do keep things going. So this Project 2025 then is to fix what you just pointed out, that Trump didn't actually do the job. Didn't probably know what the job was, but this is the think tank world going, don't worry, we got your back. We're going to bring you the loyalists. Or am I reading this wrong?
No. Well, the way it's written, that's exactly what they want to do, which is they want, the president to come in, get rid of about 50,000 federal employees in all the agencies, bring in 50,000 loyalists, and they would then implement whatever agenda the new administration would want. The problem with that is, and for the public, what they don't understand is rules and regulations based on laws are how the federal government operates. So Congress passes a law, the president signs the law, it comes in. The agencies then interpret the law and implement it at the agency level, whether it's your prisons, VA, you name it. Like, we'll take the PAC Act, for instance, that expands coverage for all of these veterans as far as getting new care, especially for burn pits and things like that. So the VA management puts together rules and regulations on how that is going to be implemented at the VA. And it's based off of how the law is written, and it's based off of the, you know, the record of how the law is written. And so they want to pretty much throw that out, that process. They're going to have all these people that just interpret it as one, as the administration, one person decides. You know, we have, it's just, it's a bad idea.
No, and you, as you're talking through this, my mind starts going towards the recent Supreme Court decision to get rid of the Chevron deference. So do I want a bunch of judges? I mean, we're in this weird kind of world where, you know, the VA, they know what veterans need. They know what their systems are. Do we want them making rules, or do we want judges making rules, or loyalist bureaucrats put in by someone like Trump or somebody else? I mean, we're really talking about a chaotic mess that's being created here.
Yeah, I mean, it takes a while to get these rules in place. You have to put them out for public comment. You know, there's experts that are involved that bring these things together. And I want to say this before, you know, I get 22,000 hits about the VA has its problems. It does. It's a big agency. It's trying to take care of all these veterans that came back from Afghanistan, Iraq, all of the Korean War vets are now, you know, toward, you know, God forbid, toward the end of their lives. You got Vietnam vets they deal with. So, you know, I don't want it to sound like this is some sort of, you know, panacea here. The issue, though, is you got to have a standard way of getting these rules in place so employees understand what they're supposed to do, so the public, so veterans understand what they're supposed to do. And we get these benefits to veterans the way they need it. The same with the other agencies like meat inspection, same way there, same way with Bureau of Prisons and federal prisons. We want rules in place that make sense for the inmates, for the staff, and for the visitors, and for the public. Those things all go through a process, a rulemaking process, and we don't want to short-circuit that.
So last line of questioning I got for you, obviously on Sunday, big news, President Biden is stepping aside. He gave a full-throated endorsement to Kamala Harris to be his successor. I think it was the right move. I'm curious your thoughts, and for your union, what are the thoughts here? I mean, now it kind of throws things into a little bit of a chaotic situation, but ultimately good, bad. Any thoughts?
Well, obviously Biden has been very good for federal workers compared to what we had in the last administration. Vice President Harris understands that. I think she's well versed on what goes on in the federal sector at this point. She was a senator. The issue for us is we have an endorsement process that we'll have to go back to, I believe. I think our National Executive Council will meet on this fairly quickly and talk about steps forward as far as what we're supposed to do, informing our membership. That'll be part of this, and you know, how we go forward into the next 100, and I think we're at 109 days.
Yeah, no,
so, it's... Yeah, this is going to be a real quick turnaround, but we'll have to see what our process allows and doesn't allow, I guess, on our national executive.
I'm looking at this as a positive. Maybe this could be the future of elections. Maybe 3 months is all we need to get someone elected, and we don't have 2, 3, 4 years of campaigns and ads and attacks and all this stuff. Maybe we can truncate that down a bit. And maybe use those resources in a better way. But I got to tell you, in knowing what the Trump administration did to federal workers, all of the horrible things that they went after, I can't imagine that your general president or your president is going to be showing up at any RNC. Never mind. I'm sure that there's not going to be a Trump endorsement coming.
I have a sense that that's not going to happen, considering the executive orders that he did the last time and that we think will come within the first couple of weeks of a new administration, if it's Trump. He threw our union people out of their office space, negotiated office space. He eliminated some of their appeal rights and how much time they had to appeal discipline and adverse actions. There was a number of collective bargaining was cut to a very short amount of time to bargain over policies and contracts. It was terrible. And The other thing he did, and I think the private sector needs to look at this, the National Labor Relations Board and the Federal Labor Relations Authority, the general counsels of those two organizations are going to have their GCOs fired, and they will put in pro-business, pro-management people in those two places, and you will not get the decisions that we've been getting out of the Biden FLRA and LRB.
No, no, absolutely. But hey, maybe Josh Hawley will step in and help out. But Phil, as always, great talking with you. I appreciate the time. I look forward to talking to you again.
Thanks, Rick. You have a good night.
Our good friend Phil Glover. I want to hear your thoughts. You know any government employees? You know any of those evil government employees who can't be fired? Have you asked them what they do for a living and the work that they do to help us? Let me know. Email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Gonna take a quick break. Right back. Stick around.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, La Crosse's home for Up North News Radio.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Mostly cloudy tonight, scattered storms, some with heavy rainfall, muggy with a low in the mid-60s. Tomorrow, partly sunny, still a few storms, highs near 80. A little cooler and definitely less humid as we look through the rest of the week. High temperatures in the upper 70s to low 80s and mostly sunny. Currently at 75
Matt
degrees.
Matt Nair on air.
John Ellingson is our guest. He's one of the co-directors of the Eau Claire Coupe League.
It's a Swedish yard game. You would toss a baton trying to knock down your opponent's coupe.
You have teams from all over the country. What are some of the other names that stuck out to you?
Coupe Hand Luke.
Nice. Yeah.
The Salty Baton.
Oh. Do you call the last 16 teams the Swedish 16?
Oh, I'm writing that down. That's pretty good.
Matt Nair on air. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So on Tuesday, President Biden announced his plan to help working families who are struggling with the outrageous cost of rental housing as corporate landlords are really honestly and truthfully gouging working families pretty badly. In an effort to lower housing costs, the president is calling on Congress to pass legislation giving corporate landlords a choice. Good choice. Cap your increases in rents at 5%, or we're gonna take away those tax incentives, those tax breaks that you're making so much off of. He also is calling on repurposing some public land so we can build some more affordable housing. About time. Been talking about this for a very long time. And this is good stuff. It's a good start. I think it's going to help move in the right direction. But this whole rental property, this outrageous costs, these corporate landlords who are just basically robbing and pillaging, how can we rein some of this in and what should we be doing and how do we get here? That's why I've asked Nidhi Hedgi to come talk with us. Nidhi is the interim executive director at the American Economic Liberties Project, their website, economicliberties.us. Nidhi, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with the president's big plan here. He's calling on Congress to pass some legislation, cap rents at 5%. How can he do that? And do you think it's possible that Congress, this Congress, is going to do anything?
Well, I think that, you know, this is a good thing that the president is doing because he's clearly recognizing that we have an affordability crisis when it comes to rent in this country. The rent is too damn high, as he has said, and he's calling on like Congress to pass a law where it caps like the rent increases at 5% for like large landlords. People who own like more than like 50 like units, right? These are large residential properties. But I think it's about time that this has happened because we really do have a crisis in this housing market. And the way we've gotten here is much in the way we've gotten into, you know, across economy, which is consolidation over the last, like, you know, few decades, we've really seen, like, housing rental, like, units being bought up by corporate, like, landlords, whether these are, like, big apartment units or mid-sized apartment units. Instead of having, like, individuals owning them, we're seeing, like, corporate landlords owning them. We're seeing single-family homes that are available for rent being owned by private equity. You know, they took advantage of the financial, like, crisis when there was a lot of, like, floor closure and, like, just snapped up these homes. And they, one of the results of that is that the rent has increased dramatically, evictions have gone up, and we have an affordability crisis. And I think this is just like one step that the president has proposed, but there's a lot of other exciting stuff that's also happening to address this affordability crisis in the rental market.
Yeah, I mean, the consolidation is outrageous. I mean, I remember seeing a video, you know, about a year ago of the baseball player Alex Rodriguez talking about that. You know, now he's a venture capitalist. Now he's you know, bringing in a whole bunch of money to go out and buy. I think he said he wanted to have 150,000 doorknobs. So he's going to buy up a whole bunch of rental properties because it's continual income. And then, you know, hey, just because he can, you know, willy-nilly, whatever he feels like, raise the prices if he wants to. And this, I think, is where we are, no?
Yeah, no, absolutely. This is where we are. I think in the last like decade, essentially, what we've seen is that landlords have started to use like software algorithms to set the rent. So, you know, there's been a lot of like conversation under this administration about the how like just prices have gotten too high and like people are price gouging and price fixing is happening in the economy. And it's the same case when it comes to rent. And there's this one company called RealPage, which maybe people have not heard about, but you should hear about this company because it has enormous influence on the rents that are set in the market. And they work with, you know, I think 90% of like investor grade, like multifamily rental housing. And essentially what they do is that they work with landlords who provide them with all this proprietary information about their residential like properties, you know, how many units they have, what's the size, like what's the rent that they're setting, the vacancy rate. And they take that along with like public data that's available, work out the demand and supply for a particular geography, and then spit out some recommendations to landlords saying like, here, you know, here's the rent that you should be setting to maximize revenue, not just for you, but for, you know, all the other landlords we're working with in the market. So it's essentially a cartel and collusion, and the people who are paying the price are, you know, working families across America for whom, you know, rent has increased by in double digits, and not just rent, eviction rates have gone up. That's the other thing that these landlords are doing, right? Is that, you know, they don't really care if you're being turned out, like the turner, you know, they've just, I think, in again, in double digits, you're seeing eviction rates go up because that's the other thing that RealPage recommends is like, what's the vacancy? What, like, let's artificially constrict supply so that you can maximize how much you can get.
Yeah, but what do you
so
say
that's the crisis we're in.
What do you say to going, well, you know, manufacturers have a manufacturer's suggested retail price, the MSRP. You know, how is that any different than what you're talking about in this housing thing? Housing's a product. It's a commodity. It's like anything else. You know, some would argue in a capitalist system, this is part of that. Information is power, and they have it, and consumers don't.
Yeah, but essentially, we have price-fixing laws on the book, right? And what RealPage is doing, it's facilitating like landlords to collude with that information that you have. Like you as a landlord have the information about your property, but what RealPage is essentially doing is it's taking the information from like every landlord that they work in a market, like pushing it, you know, through their algorithm and then spitting out what the rent should be for all landlords. And then it's, you know, it essentially most 90% of landlords follow that recommendation. And if they don't, and if they deviate regularly, like RealPage like kicks them out. So the incentives for a landlord to use RealPage and be part of that cartel is very high. So you don't have to like, you know, meet with other landlords in a back room somewhere. You've got software that's doing it for you and like essentially exploiting a loophole in our price fixing laws. So it's not right.
It kind of sounds like something the government maybe should, you know, I don't know, some regulator somewhere should be looking at.
Well, that is like the good news that they, you know, people are like paying attention to this. So, and there's a number of pieces of action that's happening on this. So last year in November, the DC AG filed a lawsuit against RealPage and like 14 landlords here in the Washington district, which is where I live and rents have really gone up. Then in February, you had the Arizona AG, Chris Mays also filed a lawsuit against RealPage and 9 landlords who were colluding. And excitingly, there's also a private, like, class action, like, lawsuit against RealPage in Tennessee, and that's progressed a fair bit, where the judge, they've made it through, where they've survived the motion to dismiss. The DOJ antitrust division has filed a statement of interest in support of the plaintiffs. So that case is moving along. And the Department of Justice is also taking this extremely seriously. There have been reports that they are conducting a criminal investigation into RealPage's activities. And the FBI conducted a raid in early June of Cortland Management in Atlanta at their headquarters as a part of this. So I think it's great that landlords are being finally held accountable.
No, absolutely. And the outrageous rental increases, because, you know, look, in you know, 2 years ago, I guess it's 3 years ago now, my daughter, my oldest daughter, you know, she wanted to move out and find a rental property. And the rental prices were just completely through the roof and totally outrageous. So, you know, my wife and I ended up buying a house in town, because it was actually better for us to go and buy something than it was for her to try and find a rental, which is just, you know, kind of insane. But the interesting part is, ever since we bought it, there isn't a week that goes by that I don't get a call from some headhunter going, "Hey, you want to sell that house? We buy those houses," and you know it's these rental places that who are trying to get another rental property in this market.
No, absolutely. And, you know, you could at least afford to buy. Like, for a lot of people, that's not even an option, right? Like, I mean, I used to live in Oakland, California. And I remember the first year the building management raised our rent by, like, you know, $200. And we're like, okay, we don't want to move. We've just moved to this big city. So we, like, you know, swallow the rent. The next year they raised the rent by $700, which is not something that we could, like, manage. Yeah. And this is way back in, like, 2018, which is when RealPage was really, like, kicking off. So I'm wondering if that was, like, a part of this mix. And you don't have a choice at that point. There was vacancy in the building. There was, in fact, a unit for a little bit less, but that was a choice that we were given. So we moved out. So, you know, you don't even have stability as a person, because you're being forced to move out because there's this artificial supply because of this company.
Now the federal
government... With investors... Go ahead.
You finish.
No, I was going to say that with, you know, the other thing that I think is happening is with investors, like, buying up more and more homes, like, they can afford to be aggressive. Like, it's like the call that you got, like, they can afford to, like, spend a lot more money, so they can buy up that affordable home supply, like, wait until, like, you know, whatever rules there are about it being an affordable rate, and then jack up the price as they get it to market rent. So we really do need to, like, not just build more housing, as the president has, like, suggested, but we also need to make sure that this price fixing is in check and that there isn't more consolidation in the market with private equity, you know, owning large chunks of it.
And the reality is, the larger that they are, the more properties they have, the more insulated they are from losing money if there are vacant properties. So they can leave properties vacant long enough, you know, to hold out to get the rental price that they want, unlike somebody who may own, you know, four or five properties in town as you know, a side business or their business, that needs those rentals to be filled so that they can make their mortgage payments, how things have been in the past. So it seems to me that this is, again, you know, Wall Street figuring out how to stick it to the little guy. But in looking at this, you know, what's the federal government's role in this? And I think about Section 8 housing. I think about the money that we spend in helping people get into these rentals, and how it's, you know, it's basically gouging the federal dollars. Does that play into any of this at all?
So I think there are a few things, like, you know, obviously, like, these cases are going to take some time. There are other things that folks can do in parallel. So one, like, Senator Wyden has introduced a bill which just essentially bans the use of this kind of, like, you know, software in setting, like, rental prices. So that is, like, a good step. We have Senator Klobuchar, along with a number of other Democratic senators, who just recently introduced a bill, like, you know, it's Senator Sherrod Brown, Bernie Sanders, Warren, they were all a part of it, which was looking to, you know, bring in more transparency into this market, like, essentially saying that if large, like, corporate investors or private equity was buying up big chunks of, like, the housing supply, then they would have to, like, report it to the Federal Trade Commission and DOJ so that they could actually investigate the anti-competitive effects of the market. So you have that. So that, you know, we do need like bills that make sure that, you know, folks are not taking advantage of it, as well as like you need enforcement actions, which sends a message to, you know, companies like RealPage and the executives who run them that, you know, the antitrust like cops are on the beat and you can't get away with like price fixing. I believe there's also another bill where, you know, Senator Rosen from Nevada is calling on HUD to also investigate this price gouging that is happening and like looking at what's happening in the affordable housing market. So it's sort of an all hands on deck moment to address it.
Something definitely needs to be done. And I've been saying for years, we need a housing program like they had back during the FDR years. You know, I think about my grandparents who, you know, they moved in a community, you know, in a suburb of Cleveland where it was subsidized by government dollars, much like the Levitt towns that have popped up in places. You know, they funded builders to go out and build good, solid, you know, reasonable sized homes that families could afford. And they also helped ensure that there were loans available for people. There was a partnership there that we haven't had in this country for a very, very long time. And I know the right will scream socialism, but it did my grandparents really well.
Yeah, I mean, housing is everyone's biggest cost. So if you're talking about like kitchen table issues and caring about like, you know, working families and workers, then you need to like fix what's happening in terms of housing. And it's really important that you don't build housing and in the end, it just ends up as a part of the price fixing rental cartel, or it just gets all snapped up by private equity who can gouge it. So you have to make sure that if you're building it, it's actually reaching people, you know, who want it and who need it.
Finally, I got to get your thoughts on the evidently there's a judge who jumped in on the non-competes that we were supposed to be getting rid of. You know, I was celebrating the fact that, you know, Jimmy John's will no longer be able to say that peanut butter and jelly is a proprietary sandwich, that these non-competes that, you know, stifle competition and harm workers' ability to move around and fight for better wages. Now judges banning of non-competes?
Yeah, so there is a judge in the Northern District of Texas who has blocked, even it's temporary, this very popular like non-compete rule that has been proposed by the finalized by the Federal Trade Commission, which really, you know, is going to liberate about 30 million Americans so that they can have better pay and better jobs and or start their own businesses. So it's, yeah, that is like a problem in terms of, you know, a judge, like basically like, you know, this is like part of the, you know, the FTC has acted well within its authority to issue this rule. And we really hope that they swiftly appeal it because this is a misguided ruling by the judge. There's another case in Pennsylvania also related to non-competes where the rule is being challenged and that judge still has to come out with a ruling. But at least the reports say that she was a lot more skeptical and was asking some tough questions. So hopefully, you know, it goes well there.
Again, both these issues comes down to elections have consequences. And the sad reality is come November, you know, we could be going the other way on this, depending on who we vote for. But Nidney, I appreciate you taking time for us. Good stuff.
Thank you.
Nidney Hedge, the interim executive director there at the American Liberties Project. Check out their website, economicliberties.us. We'll get links out on social media. I can take a look at the work that they do. Quick break, right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. This day in labor history, the year was 1934. The Teamster members of Local 574 in Minneapolis were back out on strike. Their strike had begun 2 months prior on May 16th. The striking Teamsters had effectively shut down much of the commercial transportation in the city. One exception was made for some farmers who were allowed to bring their produce to market. The powerful Citizens Alliance, created to oppose and destroy unions, tried to defeat the strike. The police clashed violently with the strikers, who tried to keep scab drivers from breaking through their picket lines. As the strike entered its second week, other unions began to strike in support of the Teamsters. Clashes between the police and workers intensified. Minneapolis labor leaders sat down with the police and proposed a truce. The governor of Minnesota, Floyd Olson, helped to arbitrate an agreement. The Teamsters won union recognition and the right for all strikers to return to work, as well as a system of recognizing seniority. On May 25th, they called off the strike and went back to work. But soon the employers began to backpedal on the agreement. They claimed that the negotiations did not include the workers inside warehouses and only covered those who drove and unloaded vehicles. Angered, the Teamsters went back out on strike. Soon, violent clashes between the picketers and police broke out again. Two workers were shot in the back and killed. The governor declared martial law and sent in the National Guard to restore order. A federal mediator brokered another settlement, meeting the major demands of the union. It was a major victory for the Teamsters and a major victory for the workers of Minneapolis and beyond. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com. Thanks for tuning in to The Rick Smith Show. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Rick Smith Show, like us on Facebook, Instagram, and subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can find all that and much more at thericksmithshow.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So the reality is, it's about time something's done on the housing front. And look, this is one of those things that, unfortunately, I don't see anything getting done because Congress is going to have to act. And this is where we started today's program off. If you want to have working class issues addressed, you've got to have working class politicians or people who are going to be sympathetic to working class issues. Now, I talked at length about Teamsters President Sean O'Brien and how I thought it was a bad idea to be at the RNC because, look, Republicans aren't the answer. Bridging that gap and go, oh, please come over to this side. That's not the answer. And bipartisanship, we have this fascination that we can get really good outcomes when things are done in a bipartisan way. And I fundamentally disagree with this. And as, President O'Brien was going through his want for this and this magical bipartisanship, my mind went back to, because as a lifelong Teamster, the one thing that every freight Teamster thinks about is deregulation, how bad deregulation is and how bad trucking deregulation was. The Motor Carrier Act of 1980 was devastating for not just the Teamsters Union, but for the members and for workers as a whole, because it brought a standard of living down like a rock. And it was done in a major bipartisan way. Understand, like a lot of bad ideas, birthed a while ago. This was birthed under the Nixon era. It was banged around during the Ford years, and it was moved around and massaged, and then it got to the Carter years where there was massive bipartisan support, almost universal support. In fact, in the House of Representatives, only 13 people voted against it, 12 Democrats and a Republican. In the Senate, you had 70 senators vote for it, both Democrats and Republicans. Yes, Jimmy Carter put his name on it, but it was sold as this idea. It's going to help us with our fuel costs. It's going to, it's going to help consumers get, lower prices for, to fight inflation. It was thrown out and sold as all of these things that are going to help workers. And what we know about bipartisanship, what we absolutely know is workers take it on the chin. Find me a bipartisan piece of legislation that benefited working people. I go back and I think of the last real time I remember real bipartisanship where you had a lot of Republicans and a lot of Democrats. You think back to the Clinton years, the welfare reform, that didn't do any good. The telecom bill of 96. Oh, yeah, we got to loosen that up. And what do we have? Mass consolidation and the end of Glass-Steagall. Because, of course, we had learned our lesson. Now, those bills were nowhere near the bipartisanship of the Motor Carrier Act of 1980. But, you know, as I was thinking of this unicorn of bipartisanship, I couldn't help but think about what that one bill has done to an industry. When I started working in the freight business back in the late 80s, it was 85% unionized. So 85% of the less than truckload freight trucks on the road had a driver behind it, carrying a union card, making good family sustaining wages, with excellent health care benefits, with a defined benefit pension, with job security, with a say and a voice on the job. The voice that Sean O'Brien talked about at the end of his speech. That if he gets ousted from office, he's still got a CDL, he's still got a spot on a seniority list, he's still got a contract that protects him, so he can say whatever he wants because he has freedom and he can fight like you know what. And that's a good thing. That's a positive thing. But understand, the unicorn that he's searching for, that destroyed lives. So by the late 80s, there were companies going out of business left and right. Because you went from, what was it, something like 20,000 trucking companies in the U.S. in 1980 to something like 40,000 just in a few years. And by the mid-90s, you had, you know, like, what 1.5 million? So that the entry to get into the industry was so low. And all those companies that had their rights tied up and their wealth tied up in their rights, all gone. To give a modern day example, you think about the taxi drivers in New York City who spent all the money on those medallions to have the right to drive a taxi in New York City, only to have the Uber drivers come in and just crush them. And we've heard horror stories of these taxi drivers with these medallions taking their own lives because they're broke. That's this. So this bipartisanship of which he speak, I'm not buying. I know it sounds good. It does. It sounds good. We should all work for the common good. But the truth of the matter is we're always going to have different wants, different needs. There are going to be separate interests. We're not going to come together. So what has to happen is working people, and this is where I started, we need to be organizing at incredible rates. We need to be getting out in the streets and doing what my grandparents' generation did, demanding better wages, hours, conditions, demanding job security, demanding cost of living adjustments in our contracts. Understand, in this country, you're only about 6%. Unions are only about 6% of the private sector workforce, about 10% of the overall workforce. I mean, there's 90% of the people out there who should be joining and forming unions because they're all complaining about inflation, all of them. And do you know how you fight inflation? Not by blaming Joe Biden or well, you know, they gave a check out. You do that by raising wages, like my grandparents' generation did. You do that by having cost of living adjustments in your contracts so that as prices go up, your standard of living isn't completely eroded. Now, the reality is I look at this Motor Carrier Act of 1980 and the lives that it destroyed. And it was all in the name of bipartisanship. You had Nixon, you had Ford, you had Carter, you had Democrats, Republicans, all over the place, all of them. Just a handful of people on the right side of the issue. And what did we then end up with? Well, we ended up with a just-in-time inventory scenario where now people are living in trucks like caged animals. All so corporate America can make more. So yeah, when Sean O'Brien went into the RNC and he talked tough to corporate America, he talked tough to the Chamber of Commerce and the Business Roundtable and all those folks, great, those are good words. Wrong venue, wrong crowd. Should have been talking to people at their workplaces, should be talking to people on the street corner, should be talking to people everywhere you can. But here's the thing, and this is where I started today. The reality, he got his words out, but how are they going to be used? And why, again, did Trump invite him?
We know why Trump invited him, so that he can win in November and he can bring back all of the horrible labor policies that he did while he was president. The question becomes, will you, me, will working people fall for it? Did Sean O'Brien help Donald Trump? Because I don't think he helped anyone but maybe himself a little bit. I do want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick at thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At Rick at thericksmithshow.com.
Soaring high above La Crosse. This is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse. And streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.